It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back on Tuesday. Coming up later in the program, we'll get some answers to your questions about getting health coverage under the Affordable Care Act as open enrollment begins tomorrow. First, postal workers around the country are protesting plant closures with the National Day of Action to stop delaying America's mail. Here in Wisconsin, there are protests today at 4 of the Postal Service centers that are scheduled to be closed or consolidated next year in Madison, Eau Claire, Wausau, and La Crosse. Another 78 locations nationally are scheduled to be closed at the end of January, and protesters are looking for a last-minute moratorium on that action. Here with us now is Mark Diamonstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union, which represents 200,000 postal workers. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So to begin with, can you give us a snap of where postal plants are scheduled to be closed, a snapshot, if you will?
Well, there's 82 around the country, the four you listed in Wisconsin, and the others cover 37 different states, so it's widespread. And this follows 140 processing plants that are already closed throughout the country in 2012. So this is just another hit. It's wrong. It's illogical unless somebody wants to kill the Postal Service. So we're fighting back, and we're hoping to keep these plants open.
What is the thinking behind the scheduled closings? Why are they happening?
Well, the post office thing, of course, you know, you probably have to ask them exactly what they're thinking is, but their public argument is that the Postal Service needs to save money because they're in an economic crisis. But the financial crisis is manufactured by Congress. Actually, the post office is doing quite well. Their operating balance sheet was $1.4 billion plus. And while there's changes in the mail and all, there's great opportunities. So the future should be bright. But, you know, it's a question of whether it's going to be an approach to cut, and slash and burn, or whether the approach is going to be to build and enhance and expand and make sure that this institution thrives for generations forward.
There has been some bad financial news for the post office over the last several years. Last year, the Postal Service lost $5 billion, and the idea is that this may not be sustainable in the long run, the way things are going, and could lead to bankruptcy. What would you say are some better options if you want to avoid closures?
Well, can I answer that $5 billion deficit idea first?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually the hoax. The post office is making money operationally. That $5 billion is a debt on paper that Congress created in 2006, where they say the post office has to spend $5.5 billion of their money put in there by the users of the post office, no tax dollars, but by the users of the post office, and it's shifted over to the Treasury to fund retiree health benefits 75 years into the future for workers not even born yet. There's no other agency, no other business that faces that crushing burden. So they're really not in debt. This is a shell game. And then they use the shell game to tell the people of this country, oh, the post office can't do this. We have to close plants. We have to reduce service. We have to do away with overnight mail. And it's really wrong, and it's a hoax on the people of this country. So part of the reason we're out here on this day of action today is to let the people of the country know what's actually happening and what's actually going on.
What about data research that shows that people are simply sending less mail, especially less mail that's first class, that's going to return, you know, the Christmas card, the holiday card, that kind of thing. Isn't that down?
Well, the people are sending less first class letters, so the mail's changing. But we have a saying that the internet taketh and the internet giveth. So while the internet has changed first class mail, it's created an explosion in package delivery through online orders and so on. So this is not a one way ticket. So we think part of growing the post office is to make sure that the post office captures that online market, and no entity is better positioned to serve the people of this country in this period of e-commerce than the United States Postal Service, that has an infrastructure that covers every community, every nook and cranny in the land. So yes, it is changing, but it's not all downhill. Some's downhill and some's uphill.
Now, you've made the case that these closures, Wisconsin's and the nation's, would delay the country's mail. By how much are you talking about?
Well, the not just the closures, but change in what the Postal Service calls service standards, how long it goes from point A to point B. And those changes are coming in January, simultaneous with the plant closings. They will do away with overnight mail delivery basically throughout the country from one side of your town to the other, neighbor to neighbor, and it pushes back all other mail. So now if mail is two-day mail, it'll be 3- and 4-day mail. This is a time where many states are going to vote by mail, which is a great thing. This is going to kill that. This is a time of online shopping where people expect things quickly. This is a time where more and more people get their medicines through the mail. And there are many other ways that people very much use and need the postal system. So in the Wisconsin cities where this is happening, you have two things happening. The service is going to be just go absolutely down because mail is going to be shipped hundreds of miles every night rather than sorted in their town and gotten to the homes and the businesses the following day. But also there's going to be a major loss of living wage jobs. And every time that happens, not only does it affect those families, but affects the entire economic well-being of those cities. There's an economic negative impact that just spreads throughout the tax base, the small business in the area, and so on. So those cities are taking a double hit. The people of the country will take a hit on their mail service throughout, and it's a downward spiral that's just going to continue to undermine this what should be a great public service.
In terms of the number of jobs lost, how big an impact do you see that being in terms of the actual number you're anticipating?
In some of these cities, the job loss will be up to 300 or 400 folks, like in Madison. Over 100 jobs in Wausau, and up between probably 75 and 100 in the two other towns. And when you add that all up, and then all the other businesses that are associated with that, there's transportation and so on. So it has an effect on the jobs even beyond the postal workers in those areas. But that, if you add it up in Wisconsin, you're probably talking about 500, 600, 700 good living wage jobs that provide a great service to the people of this country and the people of the state and the people of those cities.
Now, you said that you see opportunity here for the United States Postal Service to grow based on the fact that people order a lot of packages online and that there's right. lots of medications, that kind of thing, and that opportunity isn't being capitalized on. But doesn't the USPS have a lot of competition from private services like FedEx and UPS?
Well, obviously there are people on the private side that do that kind of business as well, but nobody's as well situated as the post office to do it. And I never said the post office would get 100% of it or should get 100% of it, but it's a growing area where the post office can certainly grow. And there are other areas as well, by the way, in terms of growing the postal service, not necessarily in mail processing, but there's financial services, there's all sorts of licensing and so on that the postal service can do.
What are you hoping people take away from the protest today?
Well, what we're hoping people take away is, number one, an awareness that this is happening, going to happen to their mail, to their cities, to their jobs in those cities. And number two, a growing positive pressure on Congress, the Board of Governors, and the Postmaster General. We're just asking for, right now, for a one-year moratorium on these plant closures. 51 senators are already on board demanding that the post office hold off for a year. Let's see if all the parties involved, labor, industry, postal, can put their heads together, try to deal with some legislation that can relieve the post office of the burden we were talking about earlier, this $5.5 billion a year that is just choking it. And if we allow it to be choked, this is going to become Wall Street's post office, not the people's post office.
What do you think could happen in that year moratorium, if you get it, that would change people's mind?
Well, the four postal unions and much of the mailing industry have been working on compromise legislation that would both relieve the post office of this undue burden, which would change the dynamics, and then enable the post office to grow well, while keeping rates as reasonable and uniform and universal as they should be.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on and talking today.
Thank you very much. And, you know, we are the people we represent are very proud to serve the American people in the way we do, and we hope to be able to do that for generations to come.
We've been speaking with Mark Diamonstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. Today, postal workers in Wisconsin and around the country are protesting plant closures slated for next year, four of those here in Wisconsin, in Wausau, Eau Claire, La Crosse, and Madison. What do you make about those proposed plant closures? And what about mail volume being down? Do you think that this is the answer? You can continue that conversation. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. The second annual enrollment period for coverage under the Affordable Care Act begins tomorrow. Last year's rollout of healthcare.gov was rocky, and there was confusion also over the types of coverage options available through the site. So we'll find out what's different this year and what we can expect when the site once again opens for business tomorrow. Joining us now to answer these questions is Bobby Peterson. He's the founder and executive director of ABC for Health Incorporated. He joins us now in our Madison studios. Bobby, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
All right, so round two of the Affordable Care Act enrollment starts tomorrow. First off, what's different this year?
Well, we're hoping that the website's going to work a lot better. I don't see how it could work any worse than the last time around. It should be a lot simpler for people to navigate. There's a lot less screens for people to go through. And most importantly, people will be able to window shop so they can go in and look for coverage. They don't have to pull the trigger and buy it, but they can evaluate it and come back again later. So that's an important distinction from the first time, where it was real clunky and hard to navigate to go forward and backward. People got stuck, and it just didn't work.
So in terms of browsing, comparing options, you're saying that should be easier.
It should be, yeah. And all the initial reports and people that have gone into it, we've taken a look at it. It seems like it's working fairly well, at least in the preliminary phases.
And who's eligible to sign up during this period?
Mostly it's going to be people that are uninsured, people that have coverage the first time around that want to re-enroll. And this is an important element. I think that there is an option for people to be automatically enrolled into coverage. We're advising against that because things change. Coverages change. There's new options in the marketplace. So it's important for people to go in, to take a look at what the changes are, because the costs will be changing too.
Right. So let's talk about those costs changing. What do you see so far that might be differing in price in the exchanges?
I think generally, and, you know, it's hard to speak in real specifics about because there's different levels of plans, but generally the costs are holding firm. I mean, there's not major cost increases across the board, and I think that's really good news.
How long is this enrollment period compared with last time around? I believe there were some extensions last time, some special circumstances. So what's the contrast?
Right. It's a shorter enrollment period this time. It starts tomorrow and it runs for 3 months.
Okay. And how do people get started?
Well, I think you need to get to the website. You know, I mean, you should be looking at what types of coverage you need. And I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, the marketplace isn't for everybody. And it would be nice if there was a one-stop shopping point, but there really isn't. So some people may be looking at medical conditions that could be disabling, and those are evaluations for disability programs. Every county in Wisconsin, just about every county, has an aging and disability resource center for those folks. But for people that are shopping for individual insurance, the marketplace is a good place to look. There's some value there for people that are lower income. There's also opportunities to get into BadgerCare Plus for the very low income populations.
And one of the features of the Affordable Care Act has been allowing people with a pre-existing condition and illness to receive coverage. Anything changed there?
No, and that's great. You know, I've been doing this work for the last 25 years, and I used to have to battle with insurance companies for my clients that had pre-existing conditions because was it really pre-existing? Did they know about it? The insurance company found something in their medical record that looked like they may have known about it. Those days are gone, and that's really a good thing for a lot of people. The marketplace now is open to people that have pre-existing medical conditions, and they're joining a bigger pool of people, so we blend that risk, and it makes it more affordable for them and ultimately, I think, for all of us.
So do those people pay essentially the same amount for their coverage as someone in a comparable financial situation?
There's age bands within the marketplace. So you are going to, the older you get, the more expensive it's going to get. There's age ratings. So that is something that people that but it's not based upon how sick you are. So, I mean, as you get older, you're going to pay a little bit more because the likelihood of you being ill increase. But because you're ill will not cause your premiums to go up.
And in terms of buying it at all, now this was a part of the deal here. You're supposed to sign up. Again, what happens if you don't sign up?
Well, there's penalties if you don't have coverage. It's important to know that certain low-income people are exempted from the penalties. If you're covered by Medicare, you're not going to be penalized. If you're covered by Medicaid or BadgerCare Plus, you're not going to be penalized. But you have to maintain that coverage as well. So trying to avoid those gaps in coverage that could result in certain penalties is important.
Are you expecting to hear from a lot of people? Again, you know, this has been a year old. A year has gone by. But do you expect that the literacy about the plan has gone up?
Well, I think it's improved. I mean, at first, I think last year, because of the clunky rollout, you know, it was clunky. And then there was a lot of people that were frustrated and a little panicky about, like, I have to get this. I need to get into it. So it exacerbated the frustration. I think now the literacy about the marketplace has improved. It's still got a way to go. Health literacy is a broad issue across the spectrum that people need to improve. But just about the health insurance terms and issues, we still have a long way to go to educating people, but it's better.
What are some of the most common questions that people ask you when they're starting out?
You know, I think that, you know, I mean, one of the one of the funny ones is people that say, you know, I'm interested in the Affordable Care Act, but I don't want Obamacare. You know, it's like, well, you know, okay, we're going to have a little conversation about that because they're essentially the same thing. But the label, and because it's so highly politicized, people have a negative connotation without really understanding what opportunities there are. I think within the open enrollment period, the main thing that we're telling people is that there is an opportunity to look at your coverage, to evaluate it, and potentially save some money.
Got a comment here from Paul. Let's see if you can respond to. I'm in Illinois with a high-end gold BCBS plan and dental plan. My premium increase just received in the mail this week is 10%. I can live with that, and I'm a year older, but it still far exceeds the rate of inflation. Do you have any comments about premium increases?
Well, you know, the premium increases prior to the Affordable Care Act were really a lot higher than they have been since it's been enacted. So, I mean, we were in a situation where so many of those costs were just passed up right onto the consumer. We didn't have a transparent marketplace where a lot of people could look and compare plan to plan like we have in the marketplace now, and I think that's helping to keep costs down. You know, 10%, you know, he can live with that. That's probably on the higher end in terms of some of the plans in the marketplace. Some of the plans actually are going to be cheaper this year than they were last year.
So would you tell Paul to maybe shop around?
I think I'd go into the marketplace and take a look. I mean, if he is in an individual plan, he's not an employer-sponsored insurance, but he's got his own individual plan, take a look at the marketplace. It's going to depend on his income. He may find that there's more affordable options available for him.
Do you have any general advice for people about picking the best plan for you? Or is this something that you go on the site, you can pretty much see for yourself?
Well, there's some fundamentals that you need to really think about. One is, what doctors are you seeing? And what networks are a part of this plan? Because you can get into a plan that seems like it's inexpensive, but it's a smaller network. It may not include the physicians and the specialty providers that you're seeing. So it's important to know, who do you want to see, who are you seeing, and maintaining that continuity of care that you're receiving. That's a really important element that people need to consider as they look at plans. It's not just about the money.
And what about people who might go to the exchanges and say, you know, these are really not within my financial grasp right now? What avenues are open for people like that?
You know, some people, if they, you know, are low income, they might be eligible for BadgerCare Plus. You know, when you go into the marketplace, you should be evaluated potentially for BadgerCare Plus eligibility. That might be an option for you. You know, one of the troubling areas is that people's income fluctuates. No one, you know, especially a lot of low-income people, their income goes up and down, so they can fluctuate between eligibility, and that gets challenging. And the main thing is, make sure you report to the website and to the state about your changes in income.
Because it may change.
Yeah, it'll affect your subsidies, and you might be in for a surprise at the end of the year when you have to pay more in taxes than you expected.
Well, we're talking right now with Bobby Peterson of ABC Health about what to expect from the coming open enrollment period for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. It starts tomorrow. And if you've got questions about signing up for a plan through the Federal Exchange, you're wondering how the process might be different this year, or you've got some questions coming out ahead of that enrollment period that you'd like to get a handle on now, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your questions on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Tuesday. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Bobby Peterson of ABC Health about the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment begins tomorrow for coverage under the law. And we're getting answers to some frequently asked questions about buying a plan on the exchange. Now, if you've got a question about picking a plan or how to navigate healthcare.gov, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller. It's Kathleen in Mount Vernon. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 66-year-old female. I've been on disability since 1997, and I just had a birthday in October. So I'm now officially 66, and I got a letter saying that now it's just straight Social Security. There's no more disability, which is fine with me. And I have Medicare and Medicaid, and I wanted to see a certain provider at Rogers Memorial Hospital here in Madison for some counseling, and I was told I couldn't get any help there unless I had a Medigap policy. And I called a bunch of places, and because I have diabetes, they wouldn't take me because I have pre-existing conditions. Would the marketplace be something that could offer me something?
Okay, thank you, Kathleen.
Well, one of the issues for you is that you've already got Medicare and Medicaid coverage, so the marketplace is not going to be an option for you. You may want to try and get a hold of the Medigap hotline. You could probably, I don't have the number handy, but if you look it up online, they may be able to offer you some options for Medigap coverage. Typically, it's something that you get when you become eligible for Medicare. But you're in a category of folks that, for the most part, don't have to worry about the marketplace in the open enrollment period because you already have Medicare and, in your case, Medicaid coverage as well.
And if it's an issue of going to a particular provider, is that something that she has any recourse through with Medicare and Medicaid?
Right. I mean, I think it's going to be depending on the type of policy, you know, the Medigap policy that you have. I mean, Medicare typically is fee-for-service, and, you know, there are other categories of Medicare, Medicare Part C, that may limit some of the provider that you have. So there's a lot of details that we don't know yet about the type of coverage and why you're being restricted.
Okay, well, thank you, Kathleen, and good luck to you. And we'll move on next to Penny in Madison. Hi, Penny.
Hi. My question is this. I got insurance last year through the Affordable Health Care Act, and it was very reasonable and everything, and they upped my policy $100 just now. And I thought, that's an extraordinary amount for a one-time raise, isn't it?
Yep. Is that $100 a month?
Yeah.
Okay. And it may be that you passed from one of the age ratings, and that could cause the increase. Or what we would recommend is going into the marketplace and evaluate and see if there are more affordable coverage within the marketplace that might be available to you. There are options, so you don't want to get automatically re-enrolled into that coverage. You should evaluate and see if there are other plans out there that might be more affordable for you that are going to suit your needs, that work with the providers that you're currently seeing.
Is that something that will happen if Penny doesn't act? She'll automatically be re-enrolled in this one?
Yeah.
And what sort of time window does she have?
I'm not sure exactly what the auto enrollment process is, but I know that if people don't respond and don't proactively identify alternative coverage, they will get automatically re-enrolled. Now, so Penny, she should do it soon.
She's talking about a $100 jump in her coverage per month. Is that something that you think people on the exchanges can anticipate, that from year to year they may be changing providers each year? Most people say they have an employer-sponsored healthcare plan. They might be on that for, you know, 40, 50 years. Is that going to be not at all the case with this?
Well, I mean, I think that you'll see that a lot of employer-sponsored plans are changing quite frequently, or have been over the years, to try and handle the issue of cost. I mean, it is possible that you would be changing plans every couple of years, potentially. I think the main thing that people have to really look out for is the provider networks and the providers that they want to see. They might be able to change networks in some levels and stay with certain providers that they're interested in seeing. So there's some volatility to it.
Okay, thank you, Penny. And you can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions about open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act, which begins tomorrow, 800-642-1234. And we go next to Karen. Karen joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. So I had insurance for the Affordable Care Act, and I'm just on the border. Like, if I was in a different state that expanded Medicaid, I would have gotten that, but our governor in his wisdom refused to do that. So the insurance premiums got away from me last year, and my policy lapsed. So if I want to re-enroll, am I going to have to pay the premiums previously before I can re-enroll again? Because then it's totally cost prohibitive. Do you know what I mean? Like, so, like, let's say in I don't know, maybe it was September. The amount got away from me. So if I wanted to reinstate my insurance, it would be over $200 now. But if I re-enrolled for the coming year, am I going to have to pay that plus? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I want to address one issue first, and let's talk about the next one. But the Medicaid issue, I think, is an important one. People that are right at that edge of the boundary for Medicaid, oftentimes you can do a few things to help reduce your income to maintain eligibility for Medicaid. If you're contributing to IRAs, or if there's a 401k that your employer is contributing to, that can push your income down to help you meet those eligibility limits. Student loan expenses sometimes can be offset there. In terms of your paying the past premiums, that one I would have to research a little bit. I don't think they're going to let you in without having some opportunity to pay those past premiums. I think that defeats the purpose of insurance. So you're going to have to deal with that, and I would call healthcare.gov and talk to the representatives there and just go through what some of your options might be. They should be able to tell you what options you have for either paying the premiums and getting into a new plan.
Are there other options besides calling healthcare.gov that you would recommend?
Well, I mean, I think that, for example, if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, you may be wanting to talk to folks at your local county Aging and Disability Resource Center about options. I mean, this is a good time to evaluate your coverage, a health benefits checkup kind of issue. So look at healthcare.gov for some issues with the marketplace. Look at your Aging and Disability Resource Center for help. Maybe your insurance broker can also offer some help. The problem right now is all of these healthcare coverage programs are really in silos, and there isn't really the unifying theory of assistance out there that knows about all of it besides some of us at ABC for Health. There's only a few of us, though. So it's challenging. And, do your health benefits checkup and, go to some of the resources, get some help from family and friends, and talk to your healthcare providers. They may be able to point you in the direction. Some of them have certified application counselors on staff.
Okay, well, thank you and good luck. And we go next to Rusty in Stevens Point. Hi, Rusty.
Hello. I was looking on the marketplace the other day. I currently have group insurance through WPS. And I found that looking at the marketplace, I have they're priced somewhat the same, maybe a little higher deductible. However, with the marketplace, I receive a $120 to $180 tax break per month, which makes it much more affordable. And if you look at it through the year after your taxes, why is it that I can't get a tax break using my current insurance?
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the big advantages of the marketplace, and it's being set up that way to help, you know, people get into the marketplace. It's an opportunity for greater transparency to evaluate plans. There's a lot of people that are in your shoes, Rusty, where there are some really affordable options in the marketplace that you can get some of the subsidies. And there's also not only the subsidies, the tax subsidies that you're eligible for, but there's some cost reductions also in terms of your plans as well if you're below 250% of the federal poverty limit. Most of the people that went through the marketplace last year received some sort of subsidy. That's one of the draws of the Affordable Care Act. It's an opportunity to reduce your health care coverage costs, and it's something I'd seriously take a look at.
Okay, well, thank you, Rusty, and wish you the best. We're going to go next to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. My husband is still working part-time at 70, and we have really good insurance through his work. But when he retires, that would cost us about $1,200 a month, which, you know, we don't have retirement. We will have Social Security, and that's it. Will there be able to enroll in the marketplace or look at it at any given time?
I think that one of the things is that, you know, your husband should be eligible for Medicare, and that should be providing his coverage. Medicare Part A and Part B, and then Medicare Supplement Policy would be the best opportunity for him once, you know, I mean, he may be eligible right now. You can have some private insurance and Medicare at the same time.
And thank you very much, Mary, for the call. On to Susan in Sun Prairie. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Last year, these were my options. I paid either $400 a month for a policy with a $1,000 deductible, or I went on the marketplace and my cost was almost $800 a month. I have a non-ACA compliant plan. And this year, my options are to pay $470. I don't know what the rates are yet because they haven't been released yet. Or switch to an entirely different plan for my husband's employer, and that means having to change all the doctors that I've had for the last 20 years. Furthermore, I don't know about this year, but last year, there were no options in the marketplace, at least for Dane County, that were not HMOs. So I don't consider this affordable health care, either what was offered in the marketplace or what I'm currently paying. I think we have to get a better definition of what affordable really is, because oftentimes the only way to make it really affordable is to carry an extraordinarily high deductible, which is fine if nothing happens to you.
Okay, thank you, Susan, for your thoughts. Susan looking for something different than she's finding.
Right. It sounds like you haven't gone into the marketplace yet this year to evaluate the options. I'd take a look. There are new options that are available. There are some that are not HMO systems. And so there may be some surprises there for you. I'd go back and take a look. I mean, not everybody ends up a winner in this game, and it's unfortunate that your situation is one where you may be paying more.
And before we let you go, a recent Kaiser Family Foundation survey of uninsured Americans found that 89% of those surveyed were unaware that open enrollment begins in November or anytime soon for that matter. With that in mind, how are you trying to get the word out to people?
Well, I think it's, you know, opportunities like this, raising public awareness. And I think, you know, just people listening too, to make sure you're reaching out to families, friends, and neighbors to let them know about some of these options that exist, because there are strong networks in Wisconsin of people. We can all help each other out a little bit, inform them of options, and then direct them to some of the resources that may be out there to help them. We got a long way to go, and there's a lot of, you know, understanding and literacy issues related to the Affordable Care Act that we still need to improve upon.
Bobby, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Bobby Peterson is the founder and executive director of ABC for Health, Inc. He joined us to talk about the upcoming open enrollment period for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time for our state news roundup. This week, it's leadership changes in the Wisconsin State Legislature and more. Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here. And as always, happy Friday.
And same to you, my friend. Well, let's look at some leadership changes among the Democrats. Where does Mike Tate stand post-election?
Right. Yeah, so Mike Tate heads the Democratic Party right now in the state. And of course, You know, we're about, what, almost 2 weeks after the last election here, where the Democrats in the state, got beaten pretty badly. Lost seats in both the Assembly and the Senate. Of course, lost the governor's race as well. Mike Tate has kept a relatively low profile since that election. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering, you know, what his plans are. Will he run again? Will he not run again?
So some dangling question marks there, but what happens if he doesn't run again?
Yeah, if he doesn't run, at least one person has stepped forward to say they are interested in the job, and that's former chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, Joe Winicky. He told Joy Cardine actually yesterday that he will, quote, probably run if Tate isn't interested in continuing.
So Joy got the scoop first.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least close to first. Well, is Tate under fire? What is the reasoning going on here?
Yeah, well, Winicky suggested in the interview that, there was a circular firing squad of Democrats blaming him for last week's losses. So obviously there are a lot of people who are looking at him and his leadership and wondering, you know, is this something that we should continue with, with an eye towards the 2016 election?
And what kind of hints did Winicky give about what he might do differently if he were going to replace Tate?
Yeah, he said in general, looking back at this last election, Democrats were playing too much defense. He says they really have to be on the offensive when it comes to messaging. And he said basically that the grassroots effort should have been more robust. You know, when I say grassroots, I mean, you know, the lawn signs and that sort of thing.
And in terms of the big goals, do we have any of those? If they came up, what would that be?
Yeah, and I think this wouldn't be necessarily exclusive to Winicky. I think they'd probably also be Tate's goals as well, if he decides to run again to head the Democrats. One would be to beat Senator Ron Johnson in 2016, elect a Democratic president in 2016, and, of course, regain seats in the legislature.
So those are some very big picture goals looming on the horizon. But when will the Dems actually pick their leader?
Yeah, they have a convention coming up in June. So stay tuned.
Now, Senate Democrats picked their leader this week. So what emerged there?
Yeah. So the Democrats elected Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse to be the new minority leader. She replaces Senator Chris Larson. And so obviously, again, post-election, another big change coming in leadership for the Democrats.
Now, what has she said about her priorities going into this next legislative session?
For starters, she struck a conciliatory tone almost immediately after her election. She had really nothing negative to say about Chris Larson. She also said that she looked forward to working with the majority Republicans, especially in areas that she thinks the parties can work together. Schilling did say that Democrats will be pushing to increase the minimum wage and expand Badger Care by accepting more federal money. So those are things that the Democrats will be looking to do next year.
And what about the Assembly?
Yeah, so Representative Peter Barca from Kenosha was reelected to the position of minority leader, and this will be the third straight session that he has held that post. So at least in the Assembly, they're looking towards the familiar to lead their caucus.
Any challenges to Peter Barca?
Evan Goyke from Milwaukee did make a challenge. He argued that it was time for a change given how the Democrats fared in last week's election. In the end, the caucus decided to keep Barca as their leader.
And just as a reminder, I know we talked about this last week, but who will be leading Republicans in the legislature?
Right. So Senate Republicans reelected Scott Fitzgerald as majority leader, and the caucus in the Assembly reelected Robin Voss to be their leader. So both of them are coming back and reprising their roles.
And how about priorities for Republicans going forwards? What's on the top of their to-do list?
Yeah, several big items. Tax cuts, more specifically property tax cuts, may come up next year. A change in how the Government Accountability Board, the agency that oversees elections, how that is structured, that may come up next year. There is a desire to expand the voucher program in the state. And there is a desire to increase the amount of instruction that professors do at the UW, and they may do that through the legislative process.
Okay, and finally, we're going to wrap up with a story from the Department of Public Instruction and a new request there. What do we know?
Right, so State Superintendent Tony Evers released his budget earlier this week, and it basically, serves as sort of the opening salvo, so to speak, in the budget negotiations that will really kick off early next year. In a sense, you know, on the part of DPI, this is a wish list, and it's up to the legislature and the governor to decide ultimately what they want to do with this list.
And Evers got his wish list. What is he asking for?
Yeah, I mean, he's looking for a few things, but the headline here is he's seeking about $613 million boost in funding, and again, asking the legislature to change the funding formula, the way that we fund schools in Wisconsin.
So in terms of the specifics, what do you see in the plan?
So let's take the money first. He wants a 2.5% increase in funding for the first year of the next budget, and then a 4.9% increase in the second year of the next budget. And he's also seeking an increase in what's called categorical aid.
And funding-wise, what is your sense of what else Superintendent Evers is looking for? What would he like to do?
Yeah, he's also looking to change what's called the revenue limit. He wants to essentially raise the cap on how much districts can raise in property taxes and state aid. You know, right now, under current state law, you know, no such increase is allowed. He'd like that changed.
Now, one of the ongoing issues in Wisconsin has been the state of voucher schools. What do we know about this plan, this particular plan in voucher schools? Is Superintendent Evers proposing any changes there?
Yeah, again, voucher schools, always a very controversial subject, and one certainly that the legislature looks like they're going to expand potentially next year. Tony Evers has said, you know, he wants to change the way at least voucher schools are funded in Milwaukee, because right now taxpayers in Milwaukee are picking up the bill through a tax levy, and Evers wants that money to come out of the general fund. And this is money to pay for vouchers.
And charters the same, or did they not factor in?
I can't speak about vouchers. I can only talk only about vouchers.
And you mentioned the funding formula. What would you like to do there?
Right. So this is something that Tony Evers has talked a lot about. It comes up in his wish list, you know, so to speak, and it's come up in the last several wish lists. And basically what he wants to do is make sure every district gets a minimum amount of funding per student, and then provide additional funding to each district for certain needs. We're talking about transportation, special education, that sort of thing. I mean, right now, the current system has hurt certain districts, especially those that have seen enrollment declines in recent years.
And as far as the future of these proposals in the legislature, what can you tell us about where this might go? As you know, we have a new legislature coming in. It leans heavily Republican, yeah. And schools have been a hot button issue, not just these issues that we're talking about today, also issues of the Common Core, which will be on the table. But in terms specifically of this DPI budget request, what do we know about how it might proceed in the legislature?
I don't have a crystal ball, but I will say it's going to be an uphill battle. The Assembly and the Senate is going to be even more conservative than the last. And so I think a lot of these proposals, frankly, it's going to be an uphill battle. And it'll be interesting to see. Either way, I think Tony Evers has a tough fight on his hands going into next year with a lot of these proposals. We've heard leaders in the Assembly and Senate quoted Republicans saying that there probably isn't the appetite to change the funding formula. But we'll see.
Noah, thanks a lot for coming by.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
Noah Shinsky is WPR's Assistant News Director. He joins us every week at this time to bring us up to date on the state's top stories. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.